217-359-9338.
Down the railroad track, it makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line.
Prairie Monk, WAFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And this is Dave on the board. You're listening to the Prairie Monk program, WEFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, still green. We hear it's going to be white out there pretty soon, a little later this afternoon, and environmental issues, whatever has been on Dave's mind for the last week. Today is Sunday, April the 8th, 2018.
This is a mixed day. Lots of things have been happening during the week. But it's Pledge Drive, and we'd like you to help support this sort of programming. This week, I've been to quite a few meetings, including a genome meeting, and I missed a mitigation meeting on Friday night, but quite a few others, including a very nice meeting at Forbes Building with a young lady from the Missouri Gardens, and I'll mention that later. But just gathering up this information and bringing it to you requires a certain degree of energy and pizzazz, and David's help with personing this event and being the computer compliant behind it is rather important, and keeping this afloat so that we have the materials and tools to work with takes talent and just getting people together so that they can do interesting things is another challenge. And so the finance helps, and we wish you would contribute even small amounts. It doesn't matter, $5, $10, $15, it's a help. It all adds up. Let me ask David to say something, because he's been a station manager here for some time, He knows the same thing as I know, that we need your support to keep this rolling.
I spent about a year and a half as the interim station manager. That was most of 2013, so it's been a while. But I had been at the station for 20 years before that, and certainly have been there, still here now. And it's amazing to me, from the beginning, WEFT always has relied a huge amount on volunteer help. We need someone like a station manager. Someone needs to just be on the ground here to answer phones, to kind of keep an eye on the physical plant. But we've managed to make do with as little expense as possible. To be honest, the single largest expenses for us are not personnel. It's all, what would you call it, machines. Mm-hmm. We need to replace things out of the transmitter regularly. We fortunately just got a $5,000 grant, I believe, to replace some hardware. Boring behind-the-scenes stuff, it makes us sound better to have this new hardware that will be going into place, we think, by next month. And so we do our very best to not take the money that you give us. And we're not going to fritter this away. It goes to pay the power bill. It keeps the lights on. It keeps the power here so that we can go to the transmitter and pay for the transmitter to be on. Most of what happens here is done by volunteers, but that doesn't mean we don't need your financial support. So having just said all that, there's nobody but Dave and I here. So this would be a really bad time to call and make your pledge directly to us. If you wanted to go online to our website, weft.org, that would be a fantastic way for you to support us. As Dave said, the smallest amounts really do help us. You know, literally, if you take the seats off of the couch and you feel around, people have had parties. I understand a long time ago there would be these things called rent parties. Someone's rent was due the next day. They would throw a party. They'd spend a few bucks to get whatever, food together and things like that. People would come in and toss in a couple of bucks, and by the end of the evening, you'd have enough money to cover that family's rent for their apartment for the next month, and then somebody else would have theirs. That's kind of what people have done for WEFT. They've had get-togethers with live music, just getting together, and made the donation for, you know, whatever people chipped in to help WEFT. Innovative things like that, it can be just as simple as saying, well, I've got $10 to spare this month, and go to our website and make the pledge that way. If you wait until a little after noon, you could actually even call us here at the station. I'll be free from my engineering duties, and I could actually take your pledge. We love to hear that you folks are out there. It really makes us very happy to know that there's actually somebody listening to make that pledge. So yes, 359-9338 in about 54 minutes, I can take your pledge. Or just go to our website. It's very, very simple, and that's at weft.org.
Yes. Very good. So see what you can do to put a few dollars in the pot. Yesterday I went to a couple of memorial situations. Yeah. And even before that there was a worldwide one, which was Winnie Mandela passed, and she had done a lot of things, and that's been well broadcast on other programs. But it doesn't hurt to remember some people from overseas who have done things. And so the first one I went to was Ruth Walker, and we've mentioned her before, but she was a sculptor, an artist, a poet. She had a mind of her own and wasn't behind saying what she thought. She rescued possums. Mm-hmm. She encountered a possum with her bicycle, and it was injured, so she picked it up and took it home. It wasn't as easy as that, but and daughter said that, but and that daughter and her son were there, and they had a round table at not a round table, it's a circular. You get everyone in chairs, and they talk to each other across each other, and so it's rather friendly at the Red Herring, and that's not unusual. It's comments here and there, pawpaws in the front yard. Unfortunately, somebody's bought the house already and have taken the pawpaws down. It's just, I've seen that happen many times. It's a wonder that suddenly disappears. So an architect might have sumac, and it's hiding the house, and the people who buy take out all the sumac that take 30 odd years to grow. So I'm almost tempted to go over to the house, which is very well known, and say these were pawpaw trees, these were shrubs. They hid the house, but they are unusual shrubs. They come from the tropics. They have drip tips to their leaves so that the tropical rain will run off. They come early in the season with a really nice russet little flower. They go into fall early because the temperature is lower than they would have had in the tropics. They have a fruit that has got big seeds in it, but the flesh around them is very much like a custard apple, and that's another thing you don't know. It's sort of like a fruit salad plant. And you can pick them off the shrub, but you can also pick them off the ground. They're not the sort of item that travels well, so they bruise, but they're wonderful to eat. It's a little bit like a papaya, which is also a tropical fruit, or a mango. Those sort of flavors are there. Ruth allowed them to grow, and she had developed a friendship with the possum, and she had Soupy. Soupy was short for marsupial, and possum was a marsupial. And she would take it on a tether around the community and find the buck possums. Soupy would have a family of young possums, and she would eventually distribute them to the woods somewhere. In the long run, when they got acclimatized to who they were and what they could do in nature. She had a basement where the possums could come out into a wire cage around the house so that they would get daylight. I had taken her some possums because possums are not regarded in a very friendly manner. They're nocturnal, so they tend to open their mouth and look aggressive, and you don't know whether they're going to bite you or whatever, but she knew how to handle them, and so sometimes it was germane to take a possum to Ruth. She could cook and do things with all sorts of native plants. She could convert various foods into something that was really nice. And she would bring those to things like the Grand Prairie Friends meats. I talked to the family for a while, and there were quite a few people there. So you get to know the grandchildren and the friends and relatives, and you meet up with the people that also have very similar interests in conservation. I went from there to another memorial for John Scott. He was the Scott family is fairly well known locally. They've had a lot to do with instituting the Monticello Railroad Museum, and some of our railroad beds have been delineated by Harold Scott, who was one of three brothers that grew up in the Paxton area. And this was the elder brother. And then there's Tom, the middle, and Harold, the younger, was passed on. But he was a man that put together experimental equipment for professors who had an idea They would come to him and ask how they could institute the idea that they had. And so that was a very valuable talent. John was firstly a farmer, and then he was a captain in the army. He was a farm manager. He got a bachelor's degree before he went to the military, but then in Europe. Then he came back and became an economist, and with something like 300 papers and statistical awareness that got him awards. He had a Funks Award, which is Funks family is well known in the Bloomington area. There's Funks Grove, and this is an award that is a very respectable agricultural award. And he had three children, and his wife was also, he encouraged her to do things. So she also got a PhD and was a counselor. And it's interesting to see local people like the Barnharts, for instance, where they've grown up with farm family on both sides, but also academia. And that's leading in the Barnhart case to about 100 acres of prairie, very much close to town. It's on Vine Street and Savoy Church Street. And if you go there, you can find that the soil and water people have been involved. And so the Scott family does some of those sorts of things. And they also have family that's doing interesting things. One daughter is a geologist who is interested in botany and how the botany sorts itself out according to the geology. And so I find it very interesting and helpful to go to these sort of memorial services where I know the people fairly intimately, but then you get to know their families and their friends, and you learn a lot more about the family, and you get to communicate with the people who stay around. I do a lot of work with Tom Scott. He's a railroad engineer, and we're jointly trying to get historic trains into Champaign. So that involves knowing the family, how they are interlaced. Tom's wife, Lolita, is from Manila, and so has a very different background, and just helps to know those sort of things and not play on them, but be there. I left the cemetery at Paxton, and just took a little tour around. I first of all had observed a limestone statue. It was a gravestone that was often supported by the modern woodsman. It was sort of an insurance policy. If you're in the 1880s or earlier than that, if your husband died and you were left with a family of eight kids, then the rest of that modern woodsman society would help you out. It's like if there was a fire, that would happen. David has been talking about people putting together for rent, but some of these things were put together with group involvement, and you get to know about that. And so I walked around the cemetery looking for limestone headstones, where in this case, the first one I looked at was very heavily embossed with, it was a tree with broken trunks or sawn off trunks, that means the end of life, and an anchor. And the anchor was a very big anchor. It probably meant that this person was in the Navy and probably of some note. Inscription plates were, two or three of them were left unscripted, and that was purposeful so that future burials could be listed on the tree. Sometimes they have squirrels or arum lilies or oak clusters that are representative of death and dying and part of the symbology which is known as funereal art. It's different when you get into the area of G. G is geometry which is associated with masons. So you get the symbology of compasses and squares and swords and things put together, where this also was a society that was looking after the members of the society. It was an almost public way of preserving your life when you didn't have organized governmental support. And that still continues. We still have the Odd Fellows. Some of these organizations, like the Modern Woodsman, has become an insurance company. It's no longer a society group, but the history is there, and you can tell it once you walk into the cemetery. And then I went to Paxton. I had a lot to do with a Marine that was there. There's a Marine at Paxton, which was the highest hill between Cairo and Chicago. And if you had a heavy freight train, you had to have a pusher engine waiting there to push you over the hill. So eventually they burrowed through that, and some of that soil came down to Champaign to make underpasses that would make the railroad higher. But it made the railroad lower in Paxton, and the nickel plate would go over on the hill at the level of the hill, and the Illinois Central would go through underneath it. And the terminal, or the depot, was two-story. It was up for the nickel plate and down for the Illinois Central. And it was built like to live for 100 or 200 years, huge beams and strength that you would put with railroad depots. They unfortunately have lost out a lot to development. People don't travel as much by rail anymore. Everyone has a car. So some of the big depots have been torn down, but some still remain. And the Union Station in Chicago is one such station. The Beyer family, who actually runs a funeral home in Paxton, tried very hard to move the depot to an off space so that it would be preserved. But there really wasn't a place where they could put it. So that didn't happen. So I wandered around there a little bit, and I went to the nickel plate, which is closed out now. and abandoned. But there's a historic museum with a couple of cars and a short piece of rail line that used to be right there. And it has been merged with the Monticello Railroad Museum now, but the railroad equipment is still there, and the building is still there, so the depot. I took a few photographs of the streetscape, and really quite intact. It doesn't have a square like Monticello has a square. It's parallel to the railroad line, to the main line, the Illinois Central, not so much to the nickel plate. And these storefronts have interesting ornaments on their facades and nicely painted up. A lot of empty stores, but a water tower, which rises into the air, a city building, a city hall. It used to have a theater where you would have thespian activities, but it unfortunately got burned down in 2007. It's hard to keep these old buildings afloat because when you heat them and there's heaters, you're likely to have problems, and there's also lightning, and there's also accidental things like you might have a spark from a some piece of equipment you're using and not expect it would start a fire. I went south to a different cemetery. It's an older cemetery. It's a Prospect Cemetery. It had just been burned. It burned probably, I would guess, 2 weeks ago, and the prairie plants are starting to shoot just about a half inch of green. The tombstones are few. There are some hollows which you have to know that there was somebody buried there, and this is you falling into the grave a little bit. So there's some undulations in the cemetery. But there's not a lot of history there. And a few years ago we had a concern that people wanted to mow the prairie there to neaten up the cemetery, but the cemetery is a Illinois soil and water conservation easement, or it is preserved as a prairie site where the adjacent cemetery and reserve was loaded with prairie, and it also is in the cemetery's graves. So there are people who do probably have some relatives there. Mostly these are probably people who were buried on their way across country with covered wagons. So their relatives aren't necessarily around Paxton. But so there's been a debate about that, and eventually the prairie people have won out. It's a very unique cemetery. I wanted to say to you that when I'm at a cemetery like that on the face of a moraine, where you have to know that there was perhaps at one time there might have been 100 feet of ice, but at another time there might only have been a 4 feet or just a dribble of ice. But there were palmate streams that ran out of these cemeteries, so I could see across the landscape from the moraine, looking down across the outwash plain and then to the outwash plain river that goes towards the Wabash, and eventually it goes down as the Salt Fork of the Vermilion, and then to the Vermilion, and to the Wabash. There was a pond not too far away that was just reminded you of what it would look like on a flat land in front of the melting moraine or the melting ice. And running through the Glen Cemetery, where the Scott family was a well-manicured mown creek bed, so that you could actually see the corridor going out. And so from that little cemetery, I moved on to the Pope Cemetery at Rantoul. Now, I went in the north end, and there was a huge sign that said the street, the old road, the old Route 45 was closed. And behind the sign were two concrete barriers. So I backed off and went around the modern Route 45 to the cemetery, and through the cemetery and back on the south end. And there was a similar notice and a similar barricades. And we're very used to these. We just had one in Monticello where children were using fireworks and got caught the trestle on fire. And they had a barricade at either end that was concrete like this. And the problem is that the fire department or an ambulance or whoever can't get in there. You have to have a hi-hoe to remove the concrete. And so that meant that the fire raged on while you didn't have access. That they had to take a piece of the trestle out, because if the fire moves to a steel bridge, you can always replace a trestle, wooden trestle, but if you get fire into a steel bridge, it buckles the bridge, so you have to replace the bridge, and to replace a bridge might be a $1 million job. So we know about leaving those sorts of barricades. I walked the whole corridor because I thought, no, there might have been a lot of dumping there, but I didn't see any dumping. It may have been that the Department of Transportation had picked up some things, but I didn't see any indication of that. But somebody has decided to put a fence across this road. This road goes behind a triangle where the road ran round a cemetery rather than behind it. It's a narrow road. It goes all the way from Rantoul to Paxton, 10 miles. And we would like to see this as a bicycle trail, because it is parallel and it is reasonably narrow, and there's lots of prairie on it. And it goes up over a moraine, and you have the swampiness at the bottom. Then you have mesic material as you go up, and on the top you have dry prairie. And then you slowly go down to Ludlow with the north side of the of the moraine. And then you have, a flatland in front of the Paxton Moraine, which I was just visiting. So I walked back and forth just to make sure that something was happening here. We've been used to it. Our prairie somewhat looks like a vacant lot, and it looks like weeds. So just about 3 years ago, we had a volunteer agency that is of the Department of Transportation that moved onto that 9 acres and herbicided part of it. And that sort of was one of these situations where not everyone understands what the site is being used for. And so we need signs. We have signs. And just recently we've got more to replace signs that have worn out. So I went across to the prairie, and I had to walk across a nice little stream that comes in from the moraine. It's the Palmite Stream. And I went to the sign that's worn out and took down the signs and came back across. And I didn't see any wheelies where people have, often adults have got a pickup truck or a off-road vehicle and done wheelies on a prairie, and they can do 70 years worth of preservation in with 5 minutes of screwing around. So I was looking for that, didn't see that. So now the question is, just south of us, there's a 15-acre plot of agricultural land, and the grain on that land has to be taken out. And usually the people park their vehicles that you load your combine into, load the grain into, and they have to come out on that little road. So how do we get that sort of vehicle in there? We ourselves have to be able to maintain the prairie. I don't wish to walk in a mile. There's a interurban on the north, on the west side of the road, and that's owned by someone, and it has to be accessible. Roads are designed for you to be accessible. So I have questions for that corridor. How do we get a bus with 50 students on it to pick prairie seed? How do we get a herbicide equipment in there for spot checking plants that we can not get rid of anywhere other way, but just to spot herbicide them? How can we take a tandem truck in there? So I have questions. We have to find out who decided that the road should be closed. It's kind of historic, so we actually encourage people to go there and visit the prairie. It's an educational device, and so is the old road to Egypt. It's a road that you took 3 days to go to with a horse and cart or bullocks. You would have a corduroy road and get there. So this is part of our history. So do we actually try to educate people not to dump on that road? We have some contractors that think that it's an ideal place. They're usually small contractors and don't have big gondolas that take their junk. So they find a way of just dropping it on our prairie. We have to live with that some. We prefer to live with that rather than close the road. You don't want to just stop people from going to all sorts of places that are niches that you would like to see. It's a little bit like the pocket prairie across the way. It allows people to think and dream in a manner that you would like to encourage. So is there any alternative? Well, yes, there's Department of Transportation corridor on the other side. Unfortunately, it was destined to be a dual highway and has not become a dual highway. So it has trees planted on it, and the trees are ash trees, and the emerald ash borers decided that
that was tasty
for the borer. So those trees are dying. So if you wanted to take a road off the current Route 45 and burrow it through the mound that represents the undisturbed bed, then that would be a costly event to put such a road in. either for us or for a farmer next door. So now I have to figure out how to gently remind people that this is a natural area. This is a historic cultural site in the sense of a road. And please leave it open, and we'll deal with the dumping. And the sheriff is dealing with that too. He's caught one person there dumping, and I think the fine has been $400. So it's not inconsequential. But it's going to be a shock to someone for us to arrive and say, excuse me, could I get into the land we own? And what do you mean? We spent a whole lot of money closing it off. So what are we going to do? How do I get a bus through this site? And so I'm trying to figure out what to do about this. So I came back home, and I have other things to talk about. One of the things that I was wanting to say something about, and David might add something, is I go to a number of these meetings where there are quite a few older people, and there's a memorial service, but it's often very hard for those people to hear people who are older and have fallen voices, and they're quiet and they're sad and they're just trying to talk in a normal fashion, but this is not like a 30-year-old standing there and gesticulating and projecting. So how do we provide that sort of audience with a microphone? It's we do it with WEF sessions. We have Mike Feldman has a whole series of microphones, some of them powered with some of them directional, very narrow organ orientation, some very broad orientation. So how do we do something like the red herring and hand a microphone around without looking plastic? It's a modern technique, but over and over, I had Charles Smith was in town. He has a doctorate in music, and he plays very well, but he's autistic. So he was playing to an autistic audience or people who understood that. And he has a difficulty speaking, and there was no microphone. And then eventually there was a lavalier, which is not really quite enough to gather someone who is a concert pianist. And I was just thinking the same thing. How could we have a microphone that suits the situation? That means you almost have to have a person who has that qualification to know what microphone, and you have to have the equipment. So if you're doing it by radio, then you have to have a radio wave that goes to someone who picks up that, has a box that can pick that sort of information up. I might just ask David if he has any comment on this.
I think the most important part there was when you said microphone. The worst possible situation is if you put someone in a room and they have to rely only on their own voice to project, as you say, to fill the entire room. Getting any kind of a microphone, even just a lavalier, is better than nothing. As you know, you might have problems with feedback and this and that, but you can surmount that. What you can't surmount is somebody who can't fill the room with sound. It's simple once you've worked with it. I guess what I'm saying is it's really good if you can have at least one person who's tech savvy in the room. It's really fun when I've gone up now for 4 years with you to the to Starved Rock because there are people who are not technical in their occupation, but they've learned how to cope with the technology in the room where this meeting takes place. And I swear, this woman, she's in charge of something, but she has her own tech staff. And she knows when the microphone stops working, you turn off the amplifier, you wait 15 seconds, you turn it back on again. Surprisingly, the microphone works again. Well, this is what we tech people routinely do. Please turn off your computer. Turn it back on again. Did the problem go away? Well, good. Okay. Go back to work. So just using a microphone is most of the battle, and then the rest of it is just frills. You know, it is making things better than just tolerable.
So how do you get over the fear of a microphone? It's almost like a fear of coming in and doing a radio session. There's a fear about it. It's unknown territory, and blimey, once they get used to it, that you can't close the debate. They're used to it. So how do we get an older population that doesn't necessarily they use computers, but not necessarily for a broad spectrum of their activity? How do we get that sort of freedom so that you can have someone with a handheld microphone that goes to the person and says, "Hey, wait a sec, let me get you on."
Exactly. We want the rest of the people out there to hear what you're saying. I'll tell you what. I'm not sure that there are people who are typically afraid of the microphone. Typically, what you run into is they forget that they're holding it. And you put it in their hand, and you hold their hand in front of them, and they start talking into it. And then they realize that there's something on a slide behind them. They turn their mouth and point at the slide, forgetting the microphone should go with your mouth so that you can... And so their voice goes out when they turn and point, and it comes back again, maybe, if they remember to talk to them. But yeah, you're right. You just need people to get comfortable with the fact that this is a microphone and it's not fastened to your face. You know,
Sometimes it is. Yeah. If opera singers will have a small lavalier right near their mouth. You don't see it very much, but it's there, and it's very helpful.
Yes, and I'm sure that would be an ideal thing if you could give the one person who needs it the microphone and leave it with them. In the circumstances you're kind of talking about, you're going to be changing people every 10 minutes. Now you've got to take it off of one person and put it on the next. Interesting things to talk about in our show for environmentalism, but it's out there. I mean, a lot of people, if nothing else, quite a few of us probably have gone to memorials. I'll mention at the end of the show, I mentioned last week that Donnie Heitler passed away, and he has a memorial service coming up at the end of this, a memorial get-together, rather.
Do you know what date it is?
I do. If you want, we'll take it right now. It's Saturday, April the 28th, from 1:30 to 3 in the afternoon at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center, 601 South Lincoln. And so I'm guessing there's going to be live music. I can't imagine that that the local folks out here in this town, Jeff Helgeson and others who performed with Donnie Heitler, won't
again,
be there.
Saturday.
It's the last Saturday of this month, April the 28th. It starts at 1:30 in the afternoon. It's just an hour and a half. And this is a jazz concert. I'm guessing there'll be a jazz musicians. At the Alice Campbell Alumni Center. I'm guessing that's the Alumni Association.
A big center.
For the university.
On Lincoln.
I'm looking forward to being there. I wonder what kind of a space they will have for this. Once you've gotten used to working with technology and audio, this is your first thought. What sort of a room have they put these people into? How hard would it be to mic the room? You won't have to have mics on each person if you can get mics properly around the space.
I've been to the Campbell Center, and they do have roving mics. And if they don't have roving mics, they have standard mics. So you have to
walk up to the mic. That's right.
So that reminds me to say something about other things that have happened here, or perhaps I've got a 10 minutes. Past meetings that I thought were rather wonderful. Megan Engelhardt was here from the Missouri Botanical Gardens, and she was giving a bang-up lecture on how to go about saving plant seeds and how they harvest them in the first place, how they find a date to harvest them, to find out whether they're spread across a month, a ripening instead of 10 minutes like your tomato crop. How do you store that seed? How do you process it? How do you grow it periodically so that you don't lose contact with reality? And they're looking at hundreds of plant species in Missouri, but they also do it around the world. And there is a collection base in Norway somewhere where they're preserving seed in different places. But our plants and animals are going extinct at such a rate that we're trying to save them. And so that was a nice lecture. I went to the genome alumni presentation, and I thought it was rather wonderful. They're doing very interesting things. One of them is to have all sorts of disciplines come together in one group. They have a huge building, but only 7 labs, and they're very big labs so that people can move about and interact. And so sometimes, often, you're getting ideas from other people that drop ideas. And so talking to each other and being there and having coffee places that are outside the lab so that you can not contaminate things is wonderful. And that they're talking about doing things where they're looking at, for instance, with plants, they're looking at water preservation. They're looking at plants that have less stomates. So can they breed a plant with less stomates? Stomates are the little pores through which water moves in and out of the plant. And so at the moment, they've improved the way of defining what the gene content of a plant is or an animal. And they can almost do that mathematically and record the information. The problem then is to go out and find the plant that they want to modify or the plant that might be there anyway that they might want to breed from. So the physical representation is a problem now. So they're moving through looking at cancer, for instance, and the cancer with mice. And can they find plants, biochemicals, that will block certain processes or allow other processes? Can they do that in mice? Can they do it in rats? And they're now doing it in dogs. So they take dogs which get cancer and treat them. As yet they can't really do that with humans unless they have all sorts of regulations dispensed from the federal government. But they're finding that they can actually quiet cancerous diseases. Mm-hmm. Actually, the dogs themselves can actually find people's cancer by being able to smell or sense cancer. And so just those two examples, but to have come here to study and to hope to combine biochemistry, art, and education to break down the barrier that exists between upper-class universities and colleges so that you can spread the word. There's a tendency for the more superior colleges to be big on math and physics and chemistry, and it's bigger for the colleges sometimes to be more rote, so that they learn what happens, but they don't get to decapitate a rat that's been fed with a glucose or something like that. They don't get that experimental experience. So they're up to date by rote for 3 years, but the academic is always going to look at your farm or whatever is being looked at with skepticism. They're going to look at its physics and its math and whatnot, and they'll tell you in 5 years' time what your problem is. So there's this wonder at the college level, as a college graduate can walk into a farm and say, yes, do, 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 yes, 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 yes. And so they're very, very popular. But what I was interested in doing was bridging that gap, so there wasn't quite so much rote learning and a bit more contributory to the chemistry of things. I morphed away from that because I didn't really have the math and science background that I should have had to do that. But that's when I moved toward the preservation of prairie, because if you're going to do these things, you need a genetic gene pool. And if we manage to take out all our gene pool and we're already down to 0.1%, that's pretty hard lines, folks. So I'm doing this same sort of thing in a different sense. I talked about some of these sorts of things to city planning, because we're out there trying to bring in historic trains into Champaign. But guess what? If you bring historic trains in, the area on either side of the ballast is loaded with fairly original soil that hasn't been disturbed too much, and with prairie. So we have to look at, do we have compromise when you're down to 0.01%, when you're down to the white rhino, that's the only one left, are you going to compromise? By that time, you've lost out altogether. The rhino is going to die, and bingo, so goes the species. So are you in a compromised situation, or are you begging the trail to be narrower? That sort of debate is raging at the moment. I was very pleased, because I think in the long run we're hoping to get 33-mile railroad bed in the Monticello area into a community foundation that will be in perpetuity, and that's what we've been at for a long time. I have some announcements. The Boneyard Fest is 13th through 14th. CCDC is having an annual meeting on Sunday at 1:30.
That's the Champaign County Design?
CCDC is a Champaign County Design and Conservation Foundation. And they've been working at some of these things for a long time. And then Bill McKibben is coming to town. And he's a very prominent environmentalist, and he will be talking about CO2 accumulation and climate change. And it's interesting to see that it's becoming not a political question. People on both sides of the aisle are beginning to take an interest in this. I think that gets me. Let's say a little bit more about pledge drive.
Oh, sure. So we can kind of end things here. Then the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and no one else. Let's even start your end theme song while we're going here. Pledge drive, vitally important. While you've been talking, I've been thinking more about what I said. WEFT has been economizing and economizing and economizing. We're actually asking now for only about half what we used to, because we've gotten so good at being lean about things around here. So yes, the small amount that you're thinking, oh, this is all that I can afford, will go so much further. It will go twice as far as it would have, certainly 10 years ago. And if you can afford to give us a little bit more, well, we do still rely on some folks who can afford at least the basic membership level, $40. $90.10 will get you whatever our t-shirt is this time. I haven't seen a copy of it yet. Our own Edley Ben Had is doing it, so I'm sure it's going to be pretty spiffy. And if you wanted to give even more than $90.10, we actually don't want you to single-handedly give us $10,000 there. The pledge drive is over, because we would rather be able to say, look at all of the people. We are part of the community, and the community appreciates that we're out here. So It's also noon now. That means if you do call 217-359-9338, just as fast as I can stop myself from talking, I can take your pledge here at WEFT and online at weft.org.